Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We're just 9 days into our New Year's resolutions, so what better time to talk diets? You know, those things we start in January and then forget about for the next 11 and a half months. Maybe you've heard about the Five Hands Diet or the Saltwater Flush. And speaking of flush, those with a little extra dough can also try the caviar and baked potato diet. If you're less flush, just drink Diet Coke. These are a few of the ways to shed pounds like a celebrity. In her book, I'll Have What She's Having, Rebecca Harrington chronicles her hilarious misadventures following celebrity diets from Jackie O to Beyonce. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
So is this actually your profession?
That is amazing. Yes, it is my profession, actually.
Wow. Okay. So before I ask you a bunch of personal questions, let's just get a taste of what you've been going through. I guess, first of all, after your experiences doing these diets, do you have answers to questions like, why are we so fascinated by what celebrities eat?
I mean, I wish I knew. I think it's the ultimate commodification of celebrity. So if you've ever wanted to look like a celebrity or have a taste of, like, how to be them in some way, eating like them, I suppose, is a sort of fascinating thing. Because maybe, just maybe, you can, like, wake up and look like them one day or something, I think. I don't know.
I love that. Okay. So let's start with Victoria Beckham and the Five Hands Diet.
My personal nightmare. Yes, let's keep going.
Okay, Five Hands Diet. What does that mean?
It means that you are only allowed to eat five hands of food. And you may think that a hand is five fingers and like a whole hand. But in fact, what they mean by the serving size is just a palm. So it's just a palm-sized version of like nuts. It's like five nuts that you put in your hand.
So it isn't just, it couldn't be like a palm size serving of ice cream.
No, I mean, no. Wouldn't that be amazing, though? But no. No, it was just lean proteins with no sauce on them.
Which was the hardest, just in terms of sticking to it?
I'd say the hardest was Madonna's diet. Madonna's diet was incredibly, incredibly difficult. She's macrobiotic, and she just has eliminated tons of food groups from her diet. So all animal products, most fish she also doesn't eat. So it's really a lot of tempeh and sauerkraut, oddly enough.
Did you feel good on it?
No. I felt very, very hungry. I mean, like, I think macrobiotic can definitely work, and certainly that the cookbook that she has is a very, very good macrobiotic diet. So it really depends. I mean, for me personally, I felt deprived of all the animal products, but I'm generally an animal product eater, so that was probably why.
So you said the word cookbook. Is this an intrinsic component now to celebrity dieting?
A lot of them have cookbooks. You'd be surprised. But I wouldn't say it's a now thing. It's actually always been the case. Liz Taylor, published a cookbook in the 80s that's unbelievable, has very little recipes in it. It's almost entirely about her marriages and what happened in them. It's one of the best cookbooks I've ever read in my life. So she did that in, like, you know, I think the early 80s. And Greta Garbo was heavily associated with a nutritionist named Gaylord Houser. And he published cookbooks as far back as the 1930s.
So let's talk about a couple of things that Liz liked to eat when she was supposedly watching her weight.
She loved her unusual food combinations. So she ate a lot of peanut butter on top of steak. She loved this tuna salad recipe where you took tuna, shallots, a grapefruit, and then, to top it all off, tomato paste. And it was just so disgusting. I couldn't believe it.
So who was the one who actually ate the caviar and baked potato?
That was Jackie Kennedy.
Of course.
Jackie Kennedy reportedly ate one single baked potato a day. Lots of champagne, so it was kind of fun. One single baked potato a day, sour cream, and caviar.
There were only two men in your entire book.
Yes.
Karl Lagerfeld and Carmelo Anthony.
Yes.
So let's talk about Karl Lagerfeld.
He's the best.
Why?
Because everything he says is so amazingly quotable. I enjoyed reading about him so much. He has a cat named Choupette that has two ladies' maids, one for day and one for night. And he makes the ladies' maids write down what Choupette does all day in a diary, and then he reads it at the end of the day. Just a great guy. So he wrote a diet book that was a bestseller in France, called the Karl Lagerfeld Diet, and it was based on the ideas of Jean-Claude Houdret, who is a doctor of nutrition there. And basically, it's a 1,200-calorie diet, which is a very, very small caloric amount, that mostly consists of protein sachets that are just like little pods of protein that you put about a tablespoon of water onto, and then you eat them. That was very gross. And then he also drinks 11 Diet Cokes a day.
Wow. So I guess the ultimate question is, do these diets work? Did you lose weight?
I lost weight on some of them. I definitely lost weight on Beyoncé's diet. She does the Master Cleanse, which was originally invented around the 1940s. And it's just subsisting on a spicy lemonade with cayenne pepper and grade B maple syrup in it. And that's it. You don't eat solid foods. And then you gobble down like salt water in the morning to help your digestive tract. And then I also did her post-pregnancy diet, which was also essentially a version of Atkins with 2-hour bouts of exercising. And I also lost a bunch of weight on that. So yeah, I generally always lose a lot of weight, but it's a little hard to tell like what's sustainable or not. Like, I don't think I could do the Master Cleanse for the rest of my life.
Well, I'll tell you that the chronicles of you doing it have given me so many laughs to start the year with.
Thanks so much.
That was Rebecca Harrington. Her book is I'll Have What She's Having. You can read more of her celebrity diet chronicles at The Cut, New York Magazine's fashion site. Coming up, sugar. Many of us want to eat less of it in the new year. We'll examine why that may be a good thing. Next.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Concentrated fruit juice, dextrose, maltose, evaporated cane juice, fructose, cane crystals, corn syrup, carob syrup, agave, muscovado, demerara. If sugar is called by another name, it's still just as sweet. There are 56 ways to describe sugar on nutrition labels. But here's a way of describing sugar that you probably haven't heard: a chronic, dose-dependent hepatotoxin. These are the words of Dr. Robert Lustig. He's a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at UCSF and the sugar industry's biggest enemy. He's also prominently in the documentary film Fed Up. So I asked him, what is a chronic dose-dependent hepatotoxin?
All right, let's take it apart. Chronic. There are acute toxins where you keel over and die, and there are chronic toxins which kill you slowly. Sugar is a chronic toxin. It doesn't kill you with one episode. It kills you with 10,000. But that's what we have now, okay? Because sugar's with every meal. So 3 meals a day, 365 days a year, comes out to about 1,100 meals per year. Multiply that by 10 years, now you've got chronic metabolic disease. Now you've got all the diseases that sugar drives. Heart disease, lipid problems, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and likely cancer and dementia, although that's not hard and fast yet. But the others are, that's enough. And the amount of money that we spend as a society on those diseases that are driven by sugar is enormous. Well, how does that happen in such a short period of time? And the answer is because it's toxic. Now, one of the caveats to toxicity is it has to be an independent risk factor and it has to be exclusive of its calories and exclusive of its effects on obesity. So can you name another energy source that is toxic beyond its calories? Answer, alcohol. Alcohol is not toxic because it's caloric. Alcohol is toxic because it's alcohol. Well, it turns out that sugar does the exact same things inside the cell and does the exact same things in terms of disease progression as alcohol does. The diseases of sugar and alcohol are virtually identical. And why do you think children are getting the diseases of alcohol, like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Because the liver doesn't care where the energy comes from. It knows that it's going to turn excess energy into liver fat, and it's specific to sugar.
Okay, so let's talk then about the calories. We have been hearing for years now that a calorie is a calorie, and that all we need to do is exercise a little more.
And that's exactly what the food industry wants you to believe. Because if that's true, then they win. Because they can say, well, it's because you don't exercise enough, which is exactly what they do say. Or they can say, well, if a calorie is a calorie, why would you pick on our calories? Why don't you go pick on their calories? And you end up diffusing the issue so that no one's culpable. And of course, if a calorie is a calorie, everyone is responsible for what they put in their mouths. Therefore, it's the individual's fault. It's personal responsibility. So a calorie is a calorie lets them get away with laying the blame on anyone but themselves. The question is a calorie a calorie? And the answer is not even remotely. And we've actually known about this for years. I learned this in nutritional biochemistry in college back in 1975. So the notion that a calorie is a calorie and that calories are interchangeable is laughable at best and unbelievably dangerous at worst.
So in the movie, you use an example of almonds and soda.
When you consume 160 calories in almonds, how many of those do you absorb? Turns out 130. What happened to the other 30? When you consume food that has both soluble and insoluble fiber, like almonds, it forms a gel on the inside of your intestine. In my book, Fat Chance, I liken it to the hair catcher on your bathtub drain. You know, it's a plastic latticework with holes. So if you take a shower, the hair plugs up the little holes and you end up with a barrier to the water going down. Well, the same thing happens in your intestine when you have the insoluble fiber, which is like the plastic latticework, and then you have the soluble fiber, which is like the hair. It ends up forming a gel that acts as a secondary barrier, which reduces the rate of absorption of energy and other nutrients. And so what happens is the food moves through the intestine further down, less gets absorbed. The rate of rise of your blood glucose is slower and longer. Therefore, your insulin response is less. And more of what you ate gets delivered to the bacteria in your intestine. Now, each of us is 10 trillion cells, but we have 100 trillion bacteria in our intestine. They have to eat something, those bacteria. The question is, what do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did they get? And when you consume food with fiber, they're getting more, which means you're getting less. And if you're dealing with obesity, that's a really good thing. So when you eat 160 calories in almonds, you're only getting 130. What a winner. On the other hand, if you consume those 160 calories in a soda, number one, it's high fructose corn syrup, so the glucose and the fructose are already dissociated. There's no fiber. It all gets absorbed really far up early on in the intestine, goes straight to your liver, no fiber, no bacteria, no nothing, and your liver gets overwhelmed and causes chronic metabolic disease. So 160 calories pass through your lips. They have completely different metabolic fates, and one is healthy and one will kill you.
Is the description that you just gave us of the difference between how almonds are digested and soda also the reason that you're so concerned about the consumption of fruit juice and even some baby formulas?
Right. So fruit juice has some fiber. It has the soluble fiber, but it doesn't have the insoluble fiber. And you need both in order for fiber to work. If you compare the blood sugar rise from consuming a certain number of calories in apples or a certain number of calories in apple sauce or a certain number of calories in Vitamixed apples or a certain number of calories in apple juice. Turns out the apples give you a very low blood sugar rise, whereas the apple sauce, the Vitamixed apples, and the apple juice give you a much higher blood sugar rise. Now, if you want to go Vitamix your kale, you know, have at it. I don't really care. But the problem is when you Vitamix the fruit, you know, like I don't want to use a specific industry name, but, you know, there are juice bars out on the street and you know their names, guys. You know, that's really problematic. That's highly dangerous over time.
So it's kind of like a bar.
Well, sugar is the alcohol of the child. Sugar does everything that alcohol does except put you under the table. You can list the diseases that alcohol causes and the diseases that sugar causes, and they are virtually identical. But you know what? I'd rather have alcohol because you can only drink yourself under the table once a day.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Dr. Robert Lustig. He's a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at UCSF. His book is called Fat Chance, and he's featured prominently in the documentary film Fed Up. You know, one of the things that really struck me after watching Fed Up was that you and your fellow doctors are so knowledgeable and so compassionate in the way—
No, we're not.
Well,
no,
the way you view the situation, are young doctors, kids going through medical school today, taught enough about nutrition and diet so they can properly teach their obese patients?
No, they're not. In fact, nutrition is like Harry Potter's Defense Against the Dark Arts class. Teachers come, teachers go, the rules change. Bottom line, it's all garbage. And part of the reason it's all garbage is because no one's talking science. The standard model is eat less, exercise more. You know, how many calories did you eat? You know, low fat, exercise as much as you possibly can. We do not do that. We have an insulin reduction clinic. Get the insulin down any way you can because it's the insulin that's driving the weight gain and it's the insulin that's driving chronic metabolic disease. So get the insulin down any way you can. And when we do, patients lose weight of their own volition.
So how do you do that? How do you get the insulin down?
Well, you have to know what makes it go up. Two things. Refined carbohydrate, so bread, rice, pasta, potatoes, basically the Western diet, and sugar. The other thing that makes it go up is the lack of fiber. So carbohydrate, sugar, lack of fiber. I have just described the Western diet. I have just described processed food. There is an easy answer. to all of the things that are wrong with processed food. And it's not just sugar. There are 8 things wrong with processed food. Too little fiber, too little micronutrients, too little omega-3s, too much trans fats, too much alcohol, too much branched chain amino acids, too much omega-6 fatty acids, and too much sugar. And there's an easy answer for all 8. It's called real food.
So what do you say to people who say, I can't afford to eat that way?
Yes, you can. Because in fact, consuming real food actually costs less. It costs less economically at the cash register. Unfortunately, it costs more in terms of time. And that's the reason processed food took over, is because everyone now does not have time. And I recognize that. I mean, this is a big problem. And I'm very sympathetic. I am not the food Nazi. I deal with this myself because I work damn hard. But the bottom line is we have to find a new business model that supplies real food in ways that people can purchase it, consume it, and benefit from it rather than our current processed food debacle. It means rethinking the food business model.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Robert Lustig. He's a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at UCSF and the author of the book Fat Chance. When we first aired Robert Lustig's interview in 2014, it seemed to hit a nerve. Since then, sugar has emerged as enemy number one in the health community. On the flip side, a growing collection of research shows that fat might actually be our friend. As a nation, we have a complicated relationship with the F word. Good fats, bad fats, saturated, polyunsaturated, trans fats. No wonder we're all so confused. Nina Teicholz tackles this daunting topic in her meticulous book, The Big Fat Surprise. Hi, Nina.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Well, your book is really fascinating and so provocative. Maybe we should just sort of dial back and take us through sort of a primer on the difference between saturated fats and other fats like monounsaturated or unsaturated and polyunsaturated fats.
Right. Okay. So they're saturated fats are solids at room temperature. Butter, lard, tallow, coconut oil, or coconut butter, and also palm oil and butter. They are mainly solid at room temperature. Polyunsaturated fats are vegetable oils. They are liquid at room temperature. Those are things like peanut, corn, soybean oil. That's the main one that's now used in the United States. Safflower, sunflower oil. Those are all called polyunsaturated. The poly refers to the fact that the molecules, those fatty acids, all have a lot of double bonds in them. Which is important for reasons we'll talk about later. And then in between polyunsaturated and saturated fats is something called monounsaturated fats. They have one double bond, mono, and that's mainly olive oil, which has properties that kind of are in between polyunsaturated and saturated fats. So the main shift in our diet over the past 100 years has been away from saturated towards polyunsaturated fats, vegetable oils, because that's what we were told was good for health starting in 1961 with the American Heart Association, first guidelines to reduce saturated fat.
Now, what was the core reason that the health interests in the country were so concerned about saturated fat? Was there one study that came out, or did they all of a sudden become aware of a link between heart disease and saturated fat? What was sort of ground zero for the beginning of our re-education?
In the 1950s, the nation was really in a panic about the rising tide of heart disease. It had come out of nowhere to be the nation's number one killer. President Eisenhower himself had a heart attack in 1955, was out of the Oval Office. The entire nation's attention was riveted on this subject. And one scientist, a man named Ansel Keys, proposed that it was saturated fats that caused heart disease. That was based on a kind of simplistic idea, but convincing at the time, that saturated fat caused cholesterol, total cholesterol, which is all they could measure, total cholesterol went up, and that would clog your arteries. That was the basic chain of causation that he proposed. None of which turned out to be true, but he was a very charismatic and powerful figure. And he was able to implant his idea into the American Heart Association and get on the nutrition committee, convince everybody that this is the idea they should adopt. Again, remember, they're facing tremendous pressure to recommend something to middle-aged men who are terrified of this rising epidemic. And he got the American Heart Association to recommend for the first time in 1961 that Americans cut back on saturated fat to fight heart disease.
Okay, so you sort of had a throwaway line there where you said it turned out not to be true. I think that sentence would be surprising to most people even today.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why it took me almost a decade to research my book and why it has so many footnotes at the end, because it's a rather elaborate story about how this idea about saturated fat, that it caused heart disease, became implanted in our major institutions, not just the American Heart Association, but the National Institute of Health, and eventually the entire federal government. The wheels of the government started mobilizing behind this hypothesis that had never had good science behind it. One of the things I did was to go back to all the original studies that were used to underpin the recommendation that saturated fat causes heart disease. And there are just so many methodological problems and flaws with those studies, and it turns out that they really don't provide the evidence that we thought they did. So now there are two groups of scientists who've also gone back to look at all the data, and they have also concluded, that's why this saturated fat has been in the headlines so much recently, because those groups of scientists, one in 2010 and another just this year, have also concluded that the evidence really does not demonstrate that saturated fat causes heart disease.
You talk quite provocatively about the harm that has been done to women and children in particular by the insistence on banning saturated fat from the diet. Could you give me a few examples of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very sad section of the book, I think, about how when women and children were basically roped into the low-fat dietary recommendations for middle-aged men to fight heart disease, that there was no data on women and children. They had never been tested at all on that diet to see if it was remotely safe or healthy for them. So when finally, women were tested on the low-fat diet in the late 1990s, which is almost 30 years after women had been recommended to follow that diet. It turns out that they looked especially bad on a low-fat diet. Their good cholesterol, their HDL, fell precipitously. It also falls for men, but it falls more for women, meaning that their risk of heart disease was actually going up on that diet. The largest ever trial of the low-fat diet, called the Women's Health Initiative, which was also begun in the late 1990s, at the end of that trial, women for a decade had been cutting saturated fats religiously out of their diet. There was no improvement in their ability in weight loss, in their markers for diabetes or heart disease or any kind of cancer. And children also were not even, there was no testing on them at all until, I think, even the early 2000s. When they were tested on the low-fat diet, it turned out that they suffered nutritional deficiencies. And that data really has not been reckoned with. I mean, these populations were basically just scooped up in the fight against heart disease.
You know, it's so interesting because my producer, Jillian, and I were talking about how if you just looked at this issue through the lens of the McDonald's French fry, it would tell a story in all the different fats that it's been fried in throughout the years.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And so just for your listeners, the McDonald's used to fry its French fries in tallow, which is a fat from beef, from cows, and it's a hard, solid fat. The great thing about solid fats like tallow and lard and butter is that they are stable when they're heated. They don't create oxidation products, which are harmful to health. Then when we became obsessed with saturated fats and McDonald's really needed to get the tallow out of their French fries, they switched to hydrogenated vegetable oils, which are basically vegetable oils that have been hardened through a process called hydrogenation. The problem with that is that the one byproduct of that is that it creates trans fats. But The hardening of those oils makes them stable. That's the good thing about it. That means they don't oxidize when they're heated. Then in the 2000s, when trans fats became a problem, or when they finally became recognized as a problem because researchers had been yelling about that for decades but had been ignored, then McDonald's and every other fast food restaurant has had to get rid of trans fats. So what they've turned to are just regular old vegetable oils that are liquids that haven't been hardened, have not been hydrogenated. And the problem with that is that those oils are very unstable. When they're heated, they create all kinds of hundreds, literally, of oxidation products that have been known since the 1940s to, in animal experiments, to cause cirrhosis of the liver and drastically reduce life expectancy. They cause dramatic inflammation. They've been linked to Alzheimer's. I mean, there are many problems with those products that really have not been reckoned with yet. You know, when our government said we just need to get rid of trans fats, it really didn't ask the question of what we were replacing them with. So we may have, you know, a whole new health problem on our hand as fast food restaurants turn to using regular liquid oils in their fryers.
You know, now a lot of high-end chef-driven restaurants are cooking those French fries in duck fat or chicken fat or lard or beef tallow again.
Which is so great. I would love to taste them. I'm sure they're delicious. You know, and they're the cooking fats that we've had for thousands of years. So point me to such a restaurant, and I would love to try their food.
Nina, thank you so much. I mean, it's a fascinating book and such a weird, strange story.
It's been a really fascinating journey for me to go to research it all. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
That was Nina Teicholz. Her book is The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. In a minute, here's a resolution I think we can all get behind. Waste less food. We'll hear from one family that thrived on the food that others threw away.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Abundance. It's the success story of the human species, right? Yet it's also become our biggest challenge. The richest countries now have more than 150% of the food we actually need. And given that tons and tons, literally, of the food that ends up in dumpsters is perfectly fine to eat, two filmmakers, Grant Baldwin and Jenny Rustmeyer, took on a food waste challenge. They vowed to only eat food that was either found or unwanted. Their journey is the subject of a documentary film called Just Eat It, A Food Waste Story. Jenny joins me now by Skype to tell us about it. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a fascinating documentary. When you started off, what rules did you give yourselves?
So my partner Grant came up with this project. I originally was not into it at all. But basically we heard the statistic that 40% of food is getting wasted and that a lot of it was quality food. And so in order to prove that, he thought we should find the food and then actually eat it. So we challenged ourselves to live exclusively off rescued food for 6 months. And that means food that is destined for the landfill. It's either already in the dumpster or it's headed for the dumpster.
Did you immediately start by driving out to look for dumpsters?
We started looking for food locally. So we actually started in our own house. It's amazing how much food is at the back of your freezer that you've completely forgotten about. So we rescued food from our own house first, and then Grant's brother was moving. And you know, when you're moving, you're cleaning out the fridge and there's just so much stuff in there. So we were able to rescue some of that. And then we started looking at our local grocery stores, looking in their dumpsters, looking on their cull carts when they're restocking. And then slowly we moved up the supply chain so that we were driving out to the wholesale areas. And that's where we were finding these mass quantities of single products.
So let's talk about those first trips, just even to the grocery stores. Did you surreptitiously take things off of carts, or did you just ask for culls?
We tried a number of tactics. So yeah, buying directly off the cull cart without asking, just taking the food from the bottom of the cart and purchasing it at regular retail value was the easiest for me because it was the least confrontational. We found that when we asked managers in stores, they often said that they could not give food or donate food because it was imperfect or it was close to the date. And we ended up looking into a lot of the legislation around that and found out that a lot of those fears are completely unfounded. And then we also had a technique where we would ask the youngest stock boy we could find, and he would usually say, yes, ma'am, and he'd go to the back and get us whatever he'd culled for that day. So that was more successful for us.
And when you weren't able to find in grocery stores and you started actually going into dumpsters, take us through what some of your initial forays were like.
Well, initially, we found that a lot of the dumpsters were locked, and a lot of our local grocery stores have compactors, so you obviously can't access the food. It doesn't mean that they're not wasting things, you just can't see it. But eventually, we found some places that were open. We had a rule that we weren't going to break any locks or jump any fences or anything like that, and we were going to be really respectful, so leave things really clean. And we started finding mass amounts of food being wasted.
Did you most often find a combination of things in a dumpster? Give us some examples of what you would see inside.
Sure. I mean, at the wholesale level, it's as if you went to a Costco and you just knocked the entire shelf into a dumpster. So it was pallets of food. It was packaged food in a box, in another box. So it was very clean. Often you would find multiple kinds of things, but a lot. So you'd say you'd find 200 tubs of yogurt and maybe 400 containers of orange juice or something like that. So you wouldn't find everything every time, but there was a bit of a variety there. Occasionally we would find a whole dumpster full of one particular item. In the film, we actually show a dumpster full of hummus, so packages of hummus. And when you see just one product, I think that's what really hit home for me because it's so much of an obviously nutritious food.
Now, that moment is really striking in the movie, not only because it's a dumpster full of hummus, but the size of the dumpster.
Right. I mean, it was the size of a small swimming pool. I didn't realize that even orders would ever be that big of that kind of product. And I think if you work in the industry, you realize the volume and you see waste all the time and you kind of become immune to it. But for the average person out there, we didn't know that this kind of thing was going on.
So was a lot of this dumping having to do with expiration dates?
A lot of the product that we were finding was close dated. So it had a couple of weeks left on it, which I guess for wholesalers, not very much time. And it was close to the best before date. So it wasn't a safety thing. It was just about the peak freshness of the item.
For me, one of the most amazing finds was the chocolate that Grant found.
Yeah, I know. The chocolate's amazing because everybody can recognize that, first of all, why do we even have a date on chocolate? And second of all, the particular chocolate that we found, the reason it had been thrown out was that it didn't have a French label on it. Because in Canada, you need both English and French wording on it. So it really had nothing to do with the date at all.
And that was really good chocolate.
Oh, yeah. It was like quality, organic, you know, $4 a chocolate bar kind of thing. And we probably found about $13,000 worth of it.
And you ended up saving a lot of it for Halloween. The pictures of you giving these chocolate bars out are hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't want to receive a full-size chocolate bar? I remember as a kid going to houses that were giving out bigger than average things, and we thought they were amazing.
Why do you think wasting food is condoned?
I think in North America, we've worked really hard to have the abundance that we have. And, you know, it's the American dream to have as much of everything that you want. And food is just part of that. And I also think that we're kind of disassociated from the way that food is produced. Like when I'm eating an apple, I forget about all of the energy and the water and the love and the work that went into producing that item. I'm just thinking of it as something that I'm going to eat. So as we kind of look towards local foods and things like that, then we really appreciate food and all of the work that goes into it.
I mean, one of the things that really fascinated me was the emotional connection to even this abundance, this strange secondhand abundance. So Grant would have a really hard time not taking 20 cases or 10 cases of something, even if it meant that it was a drop in the bucket of what was in the dumpster, maybe 1,000 cases. And what he wasn't thinking ahead to the fact that the two of you will be consuming the same food over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody likes a good deal, right? And this food was free. So it was really hard to say no to it. And we'd pack our car as full as we could. But yeah, when you get home, you realize you have the same problem that the wholesalers and the grocery stores have. They got too much stock and nowhere to put it. Someone told me we should have bought a deep freeze, and maybe we should have done that. But I don't know if hoarding all the food is really going to solve the problem. I think it's more about logistics and actually connecting the people who have the food with people who really need the food and skipping that dumpster portion of it.
So how much money did you spend on food over the 6 months?
We spent about $200 over the 6 months, and that was really trying to purchase as much as possible at the grocery store. But in the end, we just found so much in the dumpster. It was easier to get it there. So yeah, we found about $20,000 worth of food, and we only paid about $200 for it.
Wow. You know what I love so much about this movie is there's so much good information in general about waste from wonderfully articulate people. But actually seeing what the two of you did just makes one's mind race in terms of, I mean, you think about all these young kids who are like living in motels who don't have food. And you think of, why isn't all of this stuff being donated somewhere? Why does it get end up in dumpsters?
Exactly. And I hope that people do feel that rage when they see the film. I mean, we were just at a film festival in Arizona, and someone from the local organization said that 1 in 4 children in their community was food insecure. Like 1 in 4, that's 25% of those kids don't have enough food to eat. And yet there's people throwing out vast quantities of nutritious food. So it's really about connecting those organizations. And sometimes it's just about one individual. You know, it just takes one manager at the grocery store or one person at the nonprofit to pick up the food to make that connection.
Because in fact, all the excuses that were given to you about we're afraid we'll be sued or it's not legal don't hold water anymore.
Exactly. In the U.S., there's Good Samaritan legislation. It's federal legislation, and it protects donors. You cannot be sued for donating good food to a nonprofit that is going to give it out to people in need.
Thank you so much, Jenny.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Jenny Rustmeyer. Along with her partner, Grant Baldwin, she made a documentary. It's called Just Eat It. Up next, Jonathan Gold checks out Pock Pock in Chinatown and will get tips for grilling your greens. Stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Jonathan Gold's in the studio with me. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and a weekly guest here on Good Food. Today, we're headed to Chef Andy Ricker's Pock Pock in Chinatown.
Andy Ricker, of course, does the Pock Pock restaurant in Portland. He has Pock Pock restaurants in Brooklyn. He has a very specific kind of Northern Thai food that he spent for, you know, many years living there and traveling there and tailing people who do a version of a dish that he likes. He's a great cookbook writer, too.
He's basically like a food anthropologist.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if, like, Paul Wolfert had gone to Thailand instead of Morocco.
Exactly. So given that this is a city replete with Thai restaurants and has been for several decades, where does that put him in terms of having an audience, a dining audience, understand what he's doing?
As my culture studies friends are fond of saying, there's a lot to unpack. I mean, when he opened in Portland, there was nothing remotely like the food he was serving there. And he was bringing the food directly from Thailand using Thai ingredients as best as he could, trying to keep it as close to what you would get in sort of like a village in, you know, Chiang Mai. When he took it to New York, almost the same thing. It was very much oriented to drinking food, the sort of things that you would drink with super cold beer. And it must be said that Pok Pok Chinatown is one of the best bars in L.A., I think. Not necessarily because of the excellence of the mixed drinks, though they do this gin and tonic with makrut lime that's just absolutely killer. Or the fact that the Singha is like, you know, 1/4 degree above freezing, which is magnificent on a hot day, even on a cold one. And there's a lot of, you know, super spicy snacks to eat with them. They're light, they're spicy, they're amusing. It's everything you want in a bar.
Which already sets it aside from a lot of Thai restaurants in town.
There aren't really drinking-oriented Thai restaurants in town, which is odd because so many of them, especially the ones with a big menu of Isan specialties, would be serving drinking food if they were in Thailand. But here where liquor licenses are difficult to get, they mostly aren't. Anyway, there's this – I don't know if it's a problem or it's a dilemma. But when Ricker is serving Thai food in Portland, he's serving it to a certain kind of audience. We're mostly not Thai. When he comes to Los Angeles and he's doing the same dishes, with some of them, there are versions like there's one noodle dish that he does that Jelada just does an absolutely killer version of. And he does really good roast chicken, but you can get that same kind of like Isan roast chicken at Sap Coffee Shop. Thai restaurants here, although not New York, tend to be pretty cheap. Pok Pok is not expensive, but it's at sort of the higher end of that. I mean, he famously pays his chefs a living wage. He uses super expensive ingredients, right? Like, you know, he'll have like a Mary's chicken instead of something cheap, and he will go out and get organic stuff from the farmer's market, where sometimes you don't see that at other Thai restaurants. Although a lot of Thai essentials, every Thai restaurant in town or probably in the country gets from, you know, the giant supermarket LAXC, which is almost around the corner from Pok Pok.
So it's really interesting because I can't remember the last time we actually had to talk about, like, as you say, unpack all these other issues before we, like, actually get to the menu.
Right.
So what was it like eating there? How was the food? I mean, when I've been to Pok Pok in Portland, I just don't even want to go to any other restaurant when I'm there. I just want to keep going back.
I really like the place. I mean, I keep going back and back. I mean, it has that, you know, great accommodation for me is directly on the way from, you know, my office to my house. It has a great bar. It's open pretty late. The food is swell. I'd probably go there even if it weren't great. But there's enough stuff that actually is wonderful that I do keep going back. I mean, there's a really good version of the Northern Thai stewed sort of sweet pork belly dish that you may remember from Ranuna Corn or from Lotus Siam in Las Vegas. There's a good version of like a pork collar salad that you also find on Isan menus. Here he does it with wild boar, I guess because he could find it somewhere. And it's spicy and it's sort of tingly and it's served with like mustard greens that are thrust into a thing of ice. You alternate bits of the mustard green and of the meat and then of a drink of beer, and it's great. It's like everything's sort of really ritualistic.
What about the basic palate he's dealing with? Is he edging more to the bitter and the sour rather than the sweet?
There's very little sweetness in almost anything here, which is almost odd. Here, it goes more towards the very rough, very almost fat-free food of northern Thailand. Not everything, but a lot of things are very salad-y, right? So there's like the larb with pork, which is a mint salad with, you know, greens and pork rinds and shallots. And then there's a version of that with duck, which is delicious, that has crispy bits of skin and little bits of duck liver that you wouldn't notice but give it sort of a funkiness, the toasted rice powder that you'd expect from that kind of an Isan salad. One of the problems here that I didn't find at the Portland restaurant is that the salads don't pop quite the way that they did in Portland. That being said, there's some stuff that's totally splendid. The most famous dish at the restaurant is probably the fish sauce chicken wings. It's sort of a Vietnamese take on fried wings that are very salty with fish sauce, and they're quite spicy if you ask them to be that way. And they're sweet, and they're savory, and they're crunchy, and they're like a little bit soggy in an intentional way. And you just want to eat a million of them.
Do you feel like LA's going to give Pock Pock a chance?
I hope LA gives Pock Pock a chance. I really hope it worked because it's a restaurant that Los Angeles needs. I think that it should be seen as one person's specific take on Thai food than as, you know, the Thai food messiah that some – he's not calling himself that, but other people are sort of styling him as that, which is just ludicrous. I mean, you know, you're not Italian, but you ran one of the best Italian restaurants in Los Angeles for 20 years.
I find it so odd that we've had to have this whole conversation. It's like going down a rabbit hole when we should just be able to go and enjoy the food.
Yeah, exactly so. And may I say that if the same restaurant with the same food didn't have, you know, a famous, you know, non-Thai chef attached to it, we would be applauding it as the most exciting thing in years, right?
Right.
I mean, to be able to have like both Night Market and Pock Pock and places like, you know, Gelada in town. It's just exciting. It's a great time to be eating Thai food in LA.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Pock Pock in Chinatown. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Now, it's time to check in with Laura Avery. She's the manager at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where she files this report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking with Nate Petzo, who is the owner of Maggie's Farm. We've all seen Maggie's Farm at several markets around Southern California. Maggie's has probably the largest selection of greens and herbs and lettuces and microgreens and other things. And we're talking today a little bit, Nate, about radicchio. Let's describe what that is, what it looks like, what its season is, and how you grow it.
Okay, so radicchio is nascently a member of the dandelion family, and it grows into a nice big head, which is just really dense, and it has a bitter and apple-y flavor. It takes a very long time to grow compared with some of our baby lettuces, so it can be up to 3 months, 4 months in some cases. It prefers cold weather, though with modern seed varieties, we can grow it year-round. But in the winter, the quality is definitely better. The flavor is much more of a deep, rich, satisfying flavor. People grill it. People eat it raw in salads, and it's really, really good.
There's two kinds. There's the kind that's a really, really, really tight head, and then there's the kind that's more leafy. Which ones do you grow?
We grow both varieties, and a lot of times it's the same variety. Some of them will never head up. So we plant them in long rows, and we start from transplants because growing them from seed takes a really, really long time. And when they get to a certain size, it's usually around like 45 days, we cap every one of them with what looks like it's like a rubber band, a shower cap looking thing. And it goes on every single one of them. It's the same as frisé. Without that, you get much lower percentage as heads, which is what people want generally. I really like the open. They look like a rose almost. And it's a much more of a bitter flavor when they haven't headed up because they have been photosynthesizing. So it's red when it hasn't been photosynthesizing. That's the inner part, the heart. And that has a much more mild endive flavor.
Now, what about the open leaf, the treviso? Is that the same kind of thing? And do you grow that too?
We do grow treviso. That one is a little harder to head up, but it's just the difference with treviso and regular radicchio is the treviso is much longer. It has that endive look, except it's much bigger. It's a little less bitter, but you really have to have your radicchio aficionado hat on in order to taste the difference.
And most of your stuff, I mean, a lot of your stuff is small baby greens and salad mixes. Do you ever pull some of that radicchio out and throw it in your baby salad mix?
Yeah, it's a constant member of our garden salad. We like it because it spoils really slowly. It adds a lot of flavor that baby lettuces don't have. So to get a really great salad, a lot of the times we'll mix in older leaved, you know, older, more mature heads and things like that into the baby mix, and that gives it that flavor.
So you probably have the baby mix with the radicchio all year round. When is the best season to get those nice firm heads?
The best season is probably a month from now. So, you know, it's, right now it's in what would be considered high season because it is cold, but everything that's growing was planted in hot weather. So the things that we planted at the beginning of last month, it's been cold at night, and that's really what it likes. It likes frost hours, and you're going to be getting in the next 2 or 3 weeks the things that were always cold and always, you know, in the prime of their environment.
Okay, well, thank you, Nate. Thanks a lot. And Maggie's Farm and Kenter Canyon both are many, many markets. This stuff will not be too hard to track down.
Thank you.
That was Nate Petso. He is a owner, co-owner of Maggie's Farm. And they're well known for their variety of herbs and lettuces and delicious radicchio as well. We're visiting now with Joseph Johnson, who's the chef de cuisine at Josiah Citron's newly opened Charcoal Venice restaurant on Washington Boulevard. Been open just a few months now, Joseph. We were just speaking with Nate Petso about the radicchio. Can you tell us how you're going to be using that at the restaurant?
The radicchio is prepared in a form of a salad, essentially a warm salad. So we start by marinating each component separately. We have Maui onions, radicchio from Maggie's Farms, and we also add in some almonds from Fat Uncle Farms as well, and then portobello mushrooms. They all get marinated separately in balsamic and a little bit of honey. Then afterwards, they're each grilled individually, brought back together essentially, tossed in a light vinaigrette with some fresh herbs, balsamic, and a little bit of olive oil, and then it's topped with chopped whole almonds.
And then now the radicchio, Nate was telling us, it kind of has to be chopped because it's so tightly balled up in that little head. Is that how you do it?
Well, first we quarter it while we're marinating it to grill it. That way it's not falling apart all over the grill. Then afterwards, we remove the root and break it apart just so it has a nicer texture. You get more of that flavor throughout than a big, like, hunk of radicchio in the middle of the salad.
What really is the technique for grilling it, cooking it? And if I don't have a grill, can I cook it some other way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The main technical aspect for grilling radicchio is you want to make sure the grill is hot, moderately hot, but not scorching hot. You don't want to burn the leaves up. The other main thing is, like, when you quarter, you want to get the sides of the quartered radicchio grilled nicely. The heat penetrates better and helps kind of break down the texture of the leaves. But also, if you don't have a grill, you can always just take the radicchio after it's marinated and roast it in the oven. It'll kind of give it the same effect where it'll get the kind of, like, crunchy, more cooked outside, and the inside gets more steam, but still has that nice flavor.
Do you want to flip it on both of the cut sides, or just one side is enough?
If you have it on a rack in the oven, you can just leave it on one side. You don't have to flip it.
Okay. And how long do you have to marinate them before you cook them?
You actually don't want to marinate it too long. At the most, maybe 30 minutes, or else it'll get too vinegary and sour.
Okay. All these things put together make for a terrific grilled radicchio. It's worth it.
Thank you.
That was Joseph Johnson. He's chef de cuisine at Charcoal Venice, which is Josiah Citron's new restaurant, just opened on Washington Boulevard in Venice. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We have a recipe for the grilled radicchio salad that Joseph just described. Check it out on the Good Food blog, or you can find it on my Facebook page. Just search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. If you miss any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. So many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Jillian, Camelia, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.